You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Susan Woodruff. Susan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So, Susan, let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now. I want to talk about your past, and I know you're preparing for a show. Can you tell me a little bit about what's happening in your studio now? And you're in L.A., is that correct?
Yes, I'm in L.A. on the west side, and I'm getting a show ready to be delivered. So most of my work is almost finished, and then I'll be packing it up and taking it to the gallery. And I'm doing a number of different works this series. I've done, for the past 10 years or so, I've been working on paintings and sometimes other things, performances, videos, and installations. But this show is going to be mostly paintings, and the paintings will be acrylic paint on acrylic panel. So I've taken the whole light and space idea one step further for myself by painting on a transparent surface. So the light will come behind and off the painting, because I also use a pearlescent paint which has an aqueous powder in it, so the light bounces from the surface and from behind. And also I'm doing a new series of cast pieces. So the painting that's painted on acrylic is then cast into a circular disc. So it looks very planetary. Like the new one I've done looks like a moon surface. And then I have a red one which looks like, you know, I can't say which planet, but planets maybe in my head. I don't know.
Right. But celestial, and when you talk about that, it's so interesting that you're painting on a translucent surface and light's coming from behind. So does that kind of just, how is that hung? Does the light kind of just bounce off the wall, or is there a light source? How does that
right.
work in terms of light coming?
Well, the most of the paintings will be framed with acrylic, so they'll look like acrylic boxes. So the light comes from the side and then comes behind. The cast piece will have a big surface of space behind the painting image, so the light will really be able to bounce in. And then the last piece I'm working on right now is an actual light box. There's a light box behind the painting, so there'll be light, you know, electric light coming from behind the painting, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Yeah, that's what I meant. If there was another light source, so then it's really kind of illuminated, the painting becomes like it's really emitting light.
It's really luminous. And then I'm using the nacreous powder, which is, you know, basically powdered mother of pearl, which catches reflective light. And it's, yeah. And
sounds beautiful.
I'm very much into beauty and nature, and I know it's not always fashionable to do beautiful art, but I've always been so inspired by nature, and now we are seeing space pictures and, you know, NASA and satellites, and, you know, we have so much new information of things we could only imagine about. But now artists, me in particular, I'm really reflecting on that, those ideas and those images are in my head. So I think it's a whole new way of painting, not landscapes, but nature as space.
And let's talk a little bit about that, because I know you have as I understand, a kind of special relationship to the landscape or stones and rocks or minerals. I know you were raised by your grandparents, or from what I've read, and your grandparents were also prospectors. Can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what that meant? Because I know you mentioned once that they kind of showed you something about how to, quote-unquote, read rock. So I'd love to know a little bit more about that. That sounds pretty extraordinary.
Well, my family, my mother's side, was a very bohemian, sort of desert bohemians, I would call them. They moved to Arizona, and my grandfather was a prospector, and my grandmother was in the Church of Self-Realization. She left the Catholic Church, And I mean, that was pretty wild for being in Arizona. And she was kind of my spiritual mentor. And my grandfather, and my mother was a working mother, so that's why I was around my grandparents a lot. She went back to school, she was divorced, went back to school, and became a teacher. So I was kind of, my grandparents were very close, and that was my caretakers. So my grandfather would just, teach me how to look for where would be gold. Gold would be, in a rock with copper or, a few other minerals. So in that way, I really learned to read the landscape. And my grandmother believed in the possibility of everything. So she, self-realization believed in all religions, except all religions. But her religion was very much magical, too, because she thought everything contained spirits and ideas, plants, animals, rocks. So I had that side as well. And we would practice like magic and witchcraft. And so I grew up just believing anything could happen. So that was fun for me.
I want you to go on, but that sounds like a very unusual relationship to the landscape. Where was this exactly where they were prospecting and you were growing up?
Phoenix, on the very edge of Phoenix. So on one side was houses, but on our side, because my grandfather was there so early, it was all desert. So my sister and I would just go wander the desert from the beginning. I mean, we were free-range children, we just went. And it wasn't called hiking, and we just went out and we'd just go all day and then come back. And when I became older, like 12, not that much older, my grandfather taught me to drive a pickup truck and a motorcycle. So I had a motorcycle. I could go even farther out into the desert. I could just go all day. So for me, light and safe is something I grew up with. And
wow, that sounds pretty amazing to drive, especially to drive a motorcycle at 12. That's an incredible sense of freedom that most children don't experience until much older.
Right. I was raised by non-official feminists. My mother, my grandmother, and my grandfather, too. They all raised me with the idea I could do anything. There was nothing out of reach for me. So I pretty much acted like a boy, and they encouraged it. I mean, they didn't try to put those kind of gender roles on me.
Hmm. Well, that's really, that's kind of wonderful. And your grandmother sounds like there was also a very powerful influence. As you say, she was your spiritual mentor. So how did that perhaps filter into your work? Because we are talking about landscapes, as you were saying at the beginning, or at least land formations, or even celestial formations. Maybe we can move, from when you were a child to some of the early works. Is there early performance or something where you think your grandmother's influence was is clear, or am I kind of reaching for that?
Well, I think the most influence you had for me was that a lot of people, often you're asked, how did you know you were an artist? How did you become an artist? I grew up believing I was an artist because my grandmother believed in reincarnation. And because I could always draw, I was always good at that. She told me I had been a great artist in another life. And so I believed it. So I just always thought, I'm an artist. That's it. It wasn't a career choice. So that gave me a lot of confidence that not only was I, but why couldn't I be? It was no question. So I guess I started working very early on, doing all kinds of whatever you can do as an artist. Illustration. I did illustration of wildlife and plants. And I worked in a big art factory. In my 20s, I became a printmaker. And I went to ASU, but I didn't go to art school. And I think I learned from other artists and just being around other medias. And I started doing video, and I started to do some performance and a lot. I did my biggest performance when I came to L.A., and I started a Burning Woman project.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, the Burning Woman project, and how that was started, and maybe a little bit about what happened.
Well, even though I had a great childhood growing up in Arizona, at some point I had to to leave Arizona because culturally it's also a desert. And I thought, well, I thought I'd live in L.A. So I came to L.A. I lived here for a while, and then I met my husband, Bruce, and he lived in New York. And I thought, well, New York sounds good, too. And so I moved to New York with him, and we stayed there for a while. And then I came back to L.A., and, you know, life goes on, things happen. And, you know, to deal with trauma, art is kind of a good solution. So when I came back to L.A., I felt like I needed to let go of a lot of things that happened and just start over. And one of those rituals is burning, letting go. Now I'm kind of thinking I'm an unofficial Buddhist, where I believe in, you know, moral codes for myself. But the one that makes the most sense to me is Buddhism, you know, compassion, understanding and love and all those things that make sense to me. So also letting go and not holding on to things. So I decided, well, burning man's a big deal. Why not burning a woman? Why can't a woman stand for something bigger than themselves? So I did a performance. I did a body cast of myself on paper mache and created the installation and had some people come in to do some music, and we burned it. It was small. It was not a big Burning Man experience, but it was pretty powerful because, you know, it's an old ritual and everybody can kind of connect with it, I think.
And that ritual came out of what you're saying? It, in a sense, came out of your move from New York, you know, I guess the popularization of Burning Man then, but also as a way of healing or working with trauma, right? Was that part of that what that performance was about or did? I mean, in another way, it seems like something that's a kind of feminist reaction to Burning Man, but it sounds like it was more personal for you also.
Well, I think that can be feminist. We may delve more into personal, some passionate ideas. I had a lot of, I got diagnosed with cancer very early on in my 30s. I went through surgeries, went through other health things, and that was part of coming here, starting over, letting go of the past.
Well, and also a confronting of mortality at a very early age, which most people don't experience at all, which is I would imagine a different way of looking at the world too.
Yes, it very much changes your perspective. And having the ideals I had when I grew up was helpful for that.
And what happened after Burning Woman? So now you're back in California. You did that performance or that kind of sculptural event. And then what came next for you, or what work came next?
Well, you know, that's a lot of time and energy, and I then moved on to, after Bruce and I got a residency in India right after that. And so we both said, wow, you know, we never thought we'd get to go to India, and here comes this opportunity. So we did it. We went to India for 3 months on residency. We stayed in a place where we both worked, and I was painting, at the time, after Burning Woman, I was painting mandalas because I've always had an Eastern influence in my life of ideals, of philosophy. And I was painting mandalas, and all of a sudden I just started tipping them. And the whole idea of the mandala is it's not permanent. It's, you know, the American, Native Americans wipe the sand, so do the Buddhists. They never save those pieces. So I started tipping the mandala and letting it flow off the page, off the canvas. And then it just created its own, like, landscape and world. And then it was a form of pour painting, which Frank Apollo did maybe on the floor, and, you know, many artists, which I can't think of right now, have done pour painting in the past. So I started to do it, but I started to do it then in every direction. Like, it wasn't good enough just to pour one way. I had to pour and turn and tip and pour some more because it just created these natural occurrences that were so spontaneous and beautiful, and it was exciting, and it was like walking a tightwire. You could always lose it. So I kept getting bigger and bigger with these pieces, and finally it was just too big to hold. And then I started thinking about how to make bigger pieces. So I started developing an idea for a moving easel, and I went through several models of moving easels, and then I finally had one made that was just perfect for me. It tips, it tilts. When the critic called it a tilt-a-wheel, it goes up and down and around, and so I can completely control the flow and the movement of the paint. And it's wet the whole time, moving and spinning, and it's just such a great way to work. And for me, I love to do something that hasn't been done before. As much as I'm inspired by art history and every artist that came before me, I'd like to take it a step further for myself and not tread water, to always move forward. And, you know, I always have a million ideas. It's just pinning one down and making it happen. And this one works really well for me. I've been using it for over 10 years.
That's exciting. And so then, I mean, that almost brings us up to the present, that you were using that for 10 years and back from the residency. Is that about where we are now, preparing for the George Billis show with paintings that are now translucent and have this whole different way of hanging?
Yes, this went like one step led to another, like a chain of ideas, which started in India and then now it's ended up here. I was working on gesso panels, and my new series will be on acrylic panels and casting. And, you know, I've always got more ideas about, you know, where to go next. And so when people ask me what kind of art I do, I say all, you know, because I just have done almost everything. I did a video of the moving painting by having a camera mounted over my table. And as the paint moves, it looks like a storm moving. So we videotaped for 2 days of just paint moving, not a documentary, because I would never want to do that. And then, not never, just right now. And then my friend Nathan Curry, who's a composer, he edited the movement of the paint to his movement of his music. And we came up with Looming Atmospheres. That was last year.
Well, that's very exciting. Well,
I guess that's what I mean by one thing leading to another.
Well, and also collaborations, you know, with composers is very exciting too. This almost brings us up to then where we are now, and I hope that listeners will be able to come to your show, because this interview is coming out just before your show is up. So George Billis is in Chelsea, of course, for those who don't know it, and there'll be a link to it in here in the interview. It's been great talking to you. I wanted to ask before we go, which I've been asking more people lately, is what books are you reading now, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with me, or what book or magazine? It could be off topic.
I love fiction. I read fiction all the time. I read everything. I love to read about science and space. But for my own entertainment, I love fiction, and I usually read three at a time. But I'm just starting Shadowbound by Steve Erickson. I'm just starting it. And by the way, the gallery is in Culver City, because George does have a gallery in Chelsea that I've chosen, but this one's in L.A. in Culver City.
Oh, good. I'm glad you corrected that. This one's in Culver City. And when is that one opening?
September 10th. And I'm showing with Brad Howell, a sculptor, who does reflective pieces, so more light.
That's exciting. Well, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure getting to know your work and background and a little bit about your next show. Thanks so much for talking with me, Susan.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.